Good morning, and welcome to the Richard J. Reardon Central Library. The library is now open.
Well, when you're standing near the Sphinxes, you know, right outside of Teenscape, there's windows inside the building. Where do those windows lead?
Hello, and welcome to Past Due, 100 Years of Central Library, a podcast commemorating the Central Library Centennial. As part of the Centennial, we're putting on a variety of events, a special reading challenge, and creating tons of original content for Angelenos to celebrate one of their favorite institutions, the Central Library. For more, visit lapl.org/Central100. I'm Sheridan J. Cazares, a librarian in the Exploration and Creativity Department of the Los Angeles Public Library. On today's episode, we're talking about hidden spaces and forgotten places, and believe me, there are plenty. To learn more about the mysterious windows and other hidden spaces in the Central Library, today we're talking to Library Docent Extraordinaire, Tom McQuaid. Welcome, Tom.
Thank you, Sheridan. It's been my pleasure.
So our library patron, who you just heard, was wondering about the windows you can see on the second floor of Central Library at the top of one of the staircases nearest to the Teenscape Department. There are lots of strangely placed windows inside the building at Central Library, as well as a lot of other kind of weird nooks and crannies. Why is that?
Strange indeed. So originally when the library opened up in 1926, if you came in the main entrance, now at this point when it opened up, the main entrance was on the west side or the Flower Street side. So that was floor number one. You entered into there. There was a number of services there. There was a periodicals room there. There was a magazine or newspaper room there. There's also a bookbinding room. But really your intention is you were going up to the next level. Floor number two. And floor number two is where the rotunda was. That's also where the catalogs were. That's where the librarians were. And then there were the reading rooms that you would do your work in. So that was floor number two. And then over top of that was floor number three. And that was where the offices were for the people who actually worked in the library. So we had these three floors, but in between floor number two and floor number three was a mezzanine level. And the mezzanine level was a collection of rooms that were for people who are working in level number two, doing research or writing books or that kind of thing, where they can go and work privately. Or if they had, let's say, a book club of some sort that they can gather in there. So it was a way that you can be separate from the actual wide open reading rooms, more individual spaces. So even in the reading rooms, people who, let's say, were writing a book, there was a cabinet with a lock and key that you were given that you can lock up your typewriter. Because this is before the days of laptops, and typewriters were pretty heavy at that point. So you didn't want to be lugging them around. So they would just lock it away. So it was a private room that you could work at.
That's amazing. I would have never thought about typewriter transportation and having to lock up my typewriter at the library. Like that's so cool that it was a service that we used to offer.
All right. And so just to follow up, that's where those windows come from. So what you're looking at to when you see the windows in the teen space or the north stairway area, and also on the picture book rated, picture book room, and look above the KLOS puppet theater. That's what you're looking at, is into that. What was the mezzanine level? Since the renovation of the building during the post-fire era, what was the mezzanine level became level three for floor number three, and then what was floor number three got moved up to floor number four.
Can you tell us what's behind those windows?
Right now, what it is actually is a variety of things at that time. The mezzanine level after the renovations of the late 80s and early 90s, that was became the third floor of the library. And that was more of a use for office space. So depending on what you're looking at, what you have there is on the west side, you have the storage for the special collections. North side, you have just general storage space. And then on the east side, you have the manager of research and special collections office. And that's why usually you look up there and you can see there's lights going on, because it's an office for staff.
Do you have any other favorite secret places in the building or forgotten places that might capture the imagination?
The fiction floor, in the go to the addition, you actually can go through the addition and see what was originally the art room for the 1926 library. And within there is a balcony within that room. And this was at a time where if you go up to that balcony, there was drafting tables. And so you could take books out of the art department, go up there and maybe make a reproduction or do sketches based off of that. So that was a way that, again, is sort of an extension of that mezzanine level, is that it was a way for just private work that can continue from there.
Yes. If you had come to Central Library before the 1986 fire, what are the more intriguing spaces you might have found that were lost once the building was renovated?
Well, one place that was lost, I always made this a personal thing, is they had a piano room up there. And so you could go there and actually play the piano. And of course, this was in the music department. This was in the east wing of the library. And since that time, again, since the building of the Tom Bradley wing in 93, that whole east wing was torn down to allow for that. One of the things that did get lost was the piano room, which was very popular. I mean, at one point it was having about 400 people a month were using that piano ring. And of course, this is before digital pianos. So you had to keep a piano tuner busy to actually work in there because it was just getting a lot of use. And similarly, there was a music department, so you can take musical scores off the shelves and learn a new piece all in the same library.
Wow, that's amazing. Yeah, you could grab the score, learn to play it, and then if you needed a tuner, they were there. They were there. That's amazing. So, Tom, the last time you were here, we talked about hidden spaces. We discussed the Hope Street Tunnel, which was once the main entrance to the library and now is an entrance used only by staff. A couple of former librarians who later became library volunteers, Helen Mudgett-Lover and Rennie Day, solved the mystery of when that entrance was closed to the public. Are there any other library mysteries that the Central Library volunteers have yet to solve?
Well, the big mystery, I think, overall is going to be the 1986 fire. If it was arson, who started it or what started it at the time? I think since Susan Arlen wrote her book in 2018, that raised up, renewed that question of what's going on. So it's overriding. Another question, more recent, I guess, is the fact, where's the rest of the Well of Scribes? Might have covered this earlier, is that we know the garden, what's now called McGuire Gardens on the west side, that had to be replaced. There was a series of tiered pools when the library opened up in 1926 with the cypress trees, what we see right now. But in 1969, that had all been torn out and had been turned into a parking lot. There used to be at the end of the pools what was called the Well of Scribes, and it is another sculpture by Lee Laurie, who had done all the other sculptures in the library. But when they tore out the garden in 1969, that Well of Scribes disappeared. In 2019, though, one section of it was found in Arizona and brought back here. So we do have it here in the library. And the question is, it's only part of it. Where's the rest?
Yeah, for any listeners out there who want to see the piece that we do have of the Well of Scribes, make an appointment with our Special Collections team and you can view it. It's on view in the Special Collections room here at the library. So now you know more about the old interior windows here at Central Library. Apparently they went from being part of the original 1926 mezzanine level to idiosyncratic hidden spaces once the library reopened after 1993. Another library mystery solved here on the Past to 100 podcast. A note to anyone wanting to see the Central Library in more detail, our amazing docents offer multiple tours of the building and gardens every single week, and they're completely free. You can also find tons about the building through our LAPL blog. Just look for the articles written by our expert docents. For more information, visit lapl.org. Now, let's talk about another area of the library that is certainly of interest, LAPL's Special Collections. Angie Britsky leads a department that has special rules, some special items, and is open to the public.
Hey, yeah, that's right. My name is Angie Britsky, and I'm the Senior Librarian of Digitization and Special Collections.
Welcome, welcome. Thanks so much for being here today. Will you tell us a little bit about yourself and what your department is all about?
Of course. So I've been with the library for about 12 years. I've been in this department for about two. So special collections at the Los Angeles Public Library includes a wide variety of rare and unique items, which includes archival collections, photographs, maps, rare books, prints, artist books, periodicals, newspapers, pamphlets, broadsides, travel posters. We even have 40,000 menus, fashion plates, book plates, fruit crate labels, manuscripts, and so much more. We have over 22,000 monographs, predominantly in English and Spanish. Those date back to the 15th century, with the majority published in the 18th and 19th century. We also have archival collections, which includes the Brockman Gallery Archive, Lady Otero Archive, and Bill Press Collection.
Wow. Wow. Okay. Special Collections has a ton of different items in the collection. 40,000 menus. Amazing. What's your area of expertise, would you say, like your focus area?
Zines is one of my focus. When I was at a branch in Edendale, I started that zine collection, and I maintain a collection in Hollywood. So I've been working with zines for a while.
So as part of our interview today, we asked you to select an item that you thought was sort of like special and interesting, something that would be of interest to our readers or viewers or listeners of the podcast. What do you have for us today?
So I chose the periodical Man's in Our Free Press, which was started in April 11th, 1942. This was lasted for 3 years, which is the longest running newspaper took place in a concentration camp. So it was started by a group of ambitious ex-newspaper men and women that were interested in creating like a quote-unquote community small town newspaper.
And the small town in question is Manzanar.
Correct. So it was an internment camp for Japanese Americans for 3 years.
And what would you say is sort of special about the Manzanar Free Press, and why is it in our special collections here at LAPL?
Well, you know, it's just really interesting to see this kind of, you know, publication that was written by folks that were living in this space, and having to kind of endure like leaving your home and being in this camp, and then like the tone of the paper was like very like community driven, like I said, like almost like this like small town newspaper that just kind of talks about, you know, social events and activities and you know, sports and recreation. And then realizing that you know, a few months after the publication started, there was a riot of the folks living there, and there's no mention of it in the newspaper, and there was a pause in the publication, and then it started again, and it lasted up until the closing of the camp, which was in 1943.
It's interesting. I remember reading about because this isn't the only newspaper that was produced by residents of the concentration camps. During World War II, I remember reading too that there was a sort of like editorial board that would look over the papers, which kind of would explain, I think, why it's about, oh, we're having the social dance or there's this event, but no mention of the riots. How do you think that manifests other than that in the paper itself?
It was kept very like light and positive, which, you know, in a sense, it's like, you know, under circumstances, and you don't know how long it's going to last. Like, yeah, you do want to create community, and like you want, you know, I mean, people fell in love at these camps, and you know, the children were actually like born at these camps, like, mm-hmm. And like under the circumstances, is like, how do you still create a life? And I think like, you know, my first thought was like, oh, this is, to be honest, was like, oh, this is so strange, you know, like if I were to write this newspaper under those circumstances, it would be like totally in opposition of everything that was happening and like a revolt. But like to see it as like this way of like, you know, engaging as if this is like by choice. Mm-hmm. I don't know if that makes sense.
No, that does make sense. I mean, I think this is one of those artifacts that I think is so indicative of like what happens when you're met with a really difficult historical moment. Like, what do you do as a person, you know? And then aside from being a person, I mean, the people that were producing Man's in Our Free Press and other papers like it are also professionals that have their own editorial bent, I think you hit the nail on the head. They're trying to make it so that the people living in the camps also have some kind of affirmation of life. We're having a social event, there's a dance, there's a wedding, a new baby was born, there's obituaries, I imagine, as well, because they were still continuing to live their lives, even if they were sort of set aside from the rest of society. I'm gonna have to come and take a look, because I think it's super interesting to point out, like, this paper that was produced by people that were part of this camp. And even now, what we're seeing in this country, like, the people who are currently in the detention centers, I don't think have the ability to produce a paper that would sort of jot down their thoughts or their voices or what they're experiencing in the detention centers. And I wonder what it would sound like if they did.
Totally, I agree.
Angie, let's switch gears a tiny bit. Would you let us know, like, what is digitization? That's part of the department that you work in. It's digitization and special collections. I know that it involves turning a physical item into a digital item, but how does that process happen?
Yeah, so we have, our librarians are specialized. So we have an archivist, we have a digital librarian, and we also have a metadata cataloging librarian. So when we decide we want to digitize something, so basically, you know, it's a collection or it's an archive, all three librarians work together. So first, you know, the archivist will work with the digital librarian to determine what should be digitized from a collection or from an archive. And that's carefully thought out. It's really intentional. And then once that decision is made, then the actual process of digitizing happens. So we have a large scale camera. We use the DT Versa with software Capture One. And then we also have, like, high resolution scanners. And then once, you know, the item is scanned, we make sure to, you know, properly save it, whether it's going to be for preservation or for access. So when we decide it's going to be for access, we put it on our digital platform called Tessa. And our metadata cataloging librarian will create metadata for that image, which will then make it easier for folks to access. So having the entry point and knowing what to search for. And so, yeah, so we digitize for two reasons, for preservation and for access. And we also have on Tessa the ability to request reproductions of items from our collection. So depending on whether or not there's a copyright issue, the material is basically owned by our department, Special Collections, Los Angeles Public Library.
All right. For any interested listeners out there, if you want to view the Manzanar Free Press, you'd have to make an appointment with our Digitization and Special Collections department, and you can do so at lapl.org. Click on the Locations tab, click on Central Library, and then along the right-hand side, click on Digitization and Special Collections, and you'd fill out an online form that has special hours to come and view any items in the collection based upon your research needs. If you want to view digital items that have been digitized by our Special Collections department, you can actually go to lapl.org/Tessa and look at our photo collections that are on there, special items, some of the fruit crate labels are on there, and a bunch of other sort of, like, institutional archives and even oral histories are on there available as well. What has been your favorite project in your time here at LAPL, Angie?
When I started at LAPL, one of my first positions was I was an adult librarian at the Edendale branch in Echo Park. And I applied for, I think it was like a state grant. And you had to choose a book and then create programming around it. And it was, so I chose The Mars Room by Rachel Kushner. And then the subject matter was the programming was mass incarceration and reentry. So, you know, California being the largest carceral state, I found it really important to investigate that through programming. And then also, you know, this concept of like re-entry and what does that mean, and looking into various support systems. So I worked with Susan Burton, who also published a book about, it's a memoir, but it's about the organization that she started for women who were re-entering society after being incarcerated, called A New Way of Home. I also connected with Father Greg Boyle, who started the Homeboy Industries for folks that were formerly incarcerated to, you know, have jobs and rebuild. And he's published many books, so that was, you know, on our book list. But yeah, it was like a six-month journey of really focusing, maybe more like 3 months actually, of really focusing on that topic of you know, being incarcerated and then re-entering society and that entire process. But one of the most notable programs that we did was, and this was something that Susan Burton does with many of the women that she has helped and worked with, is they do this thing called a living library, where women share their story with patrons. So we had a day where, you know, I think it was like 6 or 7 women came and shared their story to patrons. And, you know, just there were a lot of tears and like just so much like love and compassion. And it was really, I just felt like it was like cathartic and really just like a beautiful experience. And it was led by Susan Burton, who's just total powerhouse here in Los Angeles, I think.
Yeah. Amazing. I mean, it's making me think too, like, I mean, we have huge issues in our society, right? We have, you mentioned California being the largest carceral state. Like, what happens when a group of people has been detained or put into a particular camp or detention center, and then they're all released at the same time, similar to what happened post-World War II with Nisei, Nikkei, all across the country. And then eventually what's going to have to happen with the detention centers that ICE has, you know, how do we deal with those kinds of things as a society where you have this large group of people who have been detained because of the power of the state in one way or another, and then suffered traumas and had to live their lives in these places, and then they're all released, you know, in a short time frame. How do we deal with that as a society? What kind of elasticity do we need, do we require? Really big questions today on the podcast. And switching gears just a tiny bit, I'm going to ask you a question that I ask anybody who appears here on Past Due, 100 Years of Central Library. What is your favorite part of the Central Library?
Well, I'm not going to say the Rotunda, because it's gorgeous. I love it, obviously. But I do love, there's all these, areas of the library where there used to be payphones, and it's just like what once was. And then at the entrance of the library in McGuire Gardens, if you enter from there, just before the security, there's like this like payphone room, and there's 2 payphones and neither one of them work, but I don't know. I just love that space. It's just like, it just feels like an art installation. But I also, I mean, I do love David Bunn's elevator with the card catalog too. Right. So,
yeah. For any interested listeners, David Bunn is an artist who was commissioned to work on a public art installation as part of the 1993 renovations before the reopening after the fire in the Tom Bradley wing designed by Norman Pfeiffer. And what he did was that he took 9 million card catalog cards and decided that he wanted to highlight anything that had complete or comprehensive in the title, and then selected cards to fill up our 2 elevator cars that go from upper level 3 to lower level 4. The cars also have windows, and as you pass by different floors of the library, all of the different cards on that particular floor reflect the floor that you're on. So for example, if you're on the economics floor, you'll see cards that have titles relating to economics. If you go down to the history floor, you'll see cards that have titles reflecting history. So visit the Central Library here at 630 West 5th Street, and you can see the installation for yourself in the Tom Bradley wing. Thank you so much for being on the podcast today, Angie Britsky, our intrepid senior librarian of digitization and special collections.
Thank you so much.
To view any digitized items in LAPL's collection on TESSA, visit tessa.lapl.org. Today's episode was made possible by executive producer Christina Hairston and producer Stella Middlebach. It was recorded in the Octavia Lab with help from the amazing Octavia Lab staff and edited by Adrian Diebel. I'm your host, Sheridan J. Casares, with the Los Angeles Public Library. Thanks for listening to the Past Due Podcast. We'll see you at the library.